some background questions first. Is there one gear type in the community of Kodiak, as far as you know, that fishes cod the most?
It is for all gear types, hook and line and trawl and pots. And in 2017, in the federal fisheries, the hook and line total for the catcher vessels under 50 feet, the total quota was 4,790 metric tons. And the quota for the trawl catcher vessels was 13,641 metric tons. So I think that might answer your question. It's important to the hook and line sector as well, and it's very important to the trawl sector. And, of course, the pod and the jig sector also catches cod in the federal fishery as well as in the state fishery.
Okay.
So it's divided between federal and state, and it's divided between the gear types.
So, and to contrast the 2017 with last year to the coming year, 2018, I mentioned that hook and line under 50 feet last year, or this last year, 2017, the quota was 4,000 plus, almost 5,000 metric tons. This year, it's 880 metric tons. So that's how much it's dropped. And the trawl catcher vessel, last year, the total was 13,000 plus metric tons. This year, it's 2,500 metric tons. So you can see the enormity of the change.
My impression is, and you can tell me if this is correct because you were actually at the meeting, is that trawlers are more represented on the cod decline issue at the council meeting than other gear types.
At this particular council meeting, there was a lot of representation from the trawl sector, and not, at least not that I knew of, from the hook and line sector.
I
take that back. There was a hook and line trade association representative there.
Do you know why there's such a big trawl presence at this recent issue?
Well, it's just a big part of their portfolio. You know, it's a big part of their season, both A and B seasons in the Central Gulf, and it's such a big drop that it's taking the legs out from under many of the trawl operators. It's a huge hole in their portfolio. So, you know, they are also extremely well organized and have a very effective trade association, Alaska Groundfish Data Bank. That's Julie Bonney. So, you know, they have a lot of representation. They also, the Whitefish Trawlers Association has a representative who goes to all the council meetings, and that's Rebecca Skinner. And there are a few trawl harvesters who attend many of the council meetings. There's a couple of trawl harvesters from the Gulf on the advisory panel to the council. So they're there every meeting. That's Kurt Cochran and Patty O'Donnell. So they're just really well represented in the whole council process, just in general. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. It does. Turning away from gear types and all that, I did speak to Julie Bonney, and we were talking about the effects for trawlers and for processors and for Kodiak. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about, from your point of view or from what you've observed, what will be some of the main outcomes of this cod decline and the resulting cut to quota for the Kodiak community?
Well, I think it's going to be devastating. I know Julie at the meeting, I don't know if you listened to this part of the tape, but Julie likened the outcomes to the Exxon Valdez incident in 1989. It's such an enormous loss that it isn't just a few percentage points. It isn't just 50%. It's really getting close to almost 100%. And in some cases, we don't know this yet, but she may have explained to you that the in-season management people at the National Marine Fisheries Service will now try to determine how many people will be participating in all of the gear types that I mentioned, all four gear types. they'll try to figure out the number of participants potentially for this coming year, and then they'll figure out, based on these numbers that I just sort of gave you a taste of, they'll figure out whether they're going to open the fishery or not, because if they can't control the fishery adequately with because of the number of participants and the very low quotas for these sectors, they might not have fisheries at all. I mean, obviously people are hoping that doesn't happen, but the management sometimes takes the cautious approach when there's such a small quota and it's divided amongst a number of different operators. And so they will use their best judgment in trying to figure out whether it's safe, if you will, to open a particular fishery for a particular length of time and still be able to control the catch that comes out of that fishery to keep it under the quotas that were adopted by the council and are now, of course, basically the rules for this coming season. So that will take place over the next couple of weeks. And by the time the season opens for the non-trawl folks, January 1, they will know whether there's going to be a fishery. But people were super concerned at the council meeting and testified to this that, you know, there may be crew members, folks who normally work on these vessels who might be planning on it, who don't haven't heard the news and who haven't been at the meetings and haven't seen the newspapers, who might be expecting employment and maybe coming to town or staying in town or whatever, planning on working on these vessels, and there may be little, and in some cases, no opportunities. And people are really concerned about trying to get the word out. So I'm really pleased that you're putting this on the radio. I think that'll be very helpful. It doesn't solve the problem, but at least it gives people the information.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a major issue. It's going to have major consequences, so it's definitely something we want to cover. And I still have some questions about that. So as far as the potential closure, is that statewide, or what regions or gear types would it affect?
Well, that remains to be seen. I don't really want to speculate about what the in-season management at NIMS is going to do. I can actually give you some names of the people there if you'd like to talk to them about what exactly they're doing to approach this. So I'm going to try not to speculate about which fisheries could potentially not open, because I really don't know how it's going to play out. It depends, as I said, on the number of participants that end up telling the management folks. It's kind of a informal survey. Basically, they call people and say, are you going to participate in the fishery? And that, you know, that's the longline fishery, the trawl fishery, et cetera. And if they say yes, then they get put on one list, and then at the end of that survey process, they figure out how many people are likely to be fishing, and then they divide the quota into that number, and you can kind of see that if there's a lot of people participating, the quota, the number of pounds for each participant could get mighty small. So, and then the total could be worrisome to the point where they might not open. But I'm not going to speculate how that's going to happen. I mean, we'll know in a couple of weeks, or less than a couple of weeks, really, because it's barely a couple of weeks before the longline fishery opens.
Right. I'd also be curious to hear a little bit more about what you see as the next move for Kodiak, anything that might affect the Kodiak community. I know that the city and the borough are writing a letter, but I also know that the Pink Salmon Declaration hasn't gotten funding yet. So,
correct. Well, first you have to have a declaration of the disaster, and the state government plays a role in that as well, and they have addressed their letter to the governor. At the council meeting, there was a lot of conversation amongst all the stakeholders, including myself, about getting kind of the jump on that process and sort of doing a preemptive strike, if you will, and getting the disaster declaration process underway. The city and the borough were thankfully way ahead of the curve on that and had already had a draft letter written, which was really good. So they're right on top of this issue. And that letter will go to the governor, and it's a really fine piece of work. And I think that I think the situation speaks for itself, number one, and I don't think there'll be too much of a problem getting a disaster declaration. And that's the optimistic view. But frankly, it's a lot bigger number, you know, a lot bigger disaster, if you will, in terms of the drop than maybe even, you know, the pink salmon disaster in 2016. And not only that, but it's likely to last a while. The scientists are saying, based on what they saw of the year classes and so on, that they anticipate that this could last up to 2021, certainly to 2020, maybe even to 2021. And so this kind of low resource situation is looking at us for the next few years. I mean, it's almost like a double, triple, quadruple disaster because it's not just one year. So anyway, I don't think there's going to be a huge problem getting a disaster declaration. That would be my estimation.
Yeah.
But then you got to get the money, and the money has to be allocated through a different process. The delegation works on that, and they've been working on the pink salmon money for, well, as you know, that happened in 2016, so it's been a while. And they say, and this was spoken about at the meeting as well, and I'm getting the same information as the staffer for Representative Stutes, who's working really hard on this, Matt Greening. They get the same response from the delegation offices. That is, they're trying to attach it to the hurricane relief funding bill. So it has to be sort of packaged up with other disaster funding. And then if it's lucky enough to get made part of that, that money will be coming hopefully not too long from now. The COD money, given that everything else works smoothly, will have to go through the same process.
Is there anything else you think I should know, or you think listeners should know, or anything really relevant that you think you should say?
Well, you can do pretty simple math on the harvester's effects and the processor's effects, because you know the X vessel value of the cod pretty much within a little bit of one way or the other, and you also know pretty much what the first wholesale value of the cod is. And so you can do the math, knowing the difference between 2017 and 2018. You can do the math and figure out what those losses would be across the harvesting sector and the processing sector. You could even do it you could even figure out the specific losses to the trawl, the long line, and the jig and pot sectors, and then to the processors. But if you wanted to figure out what the downstream effects to the economy would be, sort of the secondary businesses dependent on fishing economics, you probably would need to do a little bit more complicated math. I spoke to McDowell Group, the people that did that economic study that we commissioned a couple of years ago, and they said that they could look in the model that they did and figure out specifically what the loss of cod might do downstream, you know, the multiplier effect in the communities. And so they're going to tell us how much that might cost in order to figure out that sort of extrapolation into the rest of the economy and the community. You can also figure out, based on the math you're doing for the harvesters and processors sectors, you can also figure out the losses on taxes, fish taxes. But, you know, sales tax is a little bit less obvious and a little bit less quantifiable. But basically you can figure out from the numbers that we now have that were just voted on at the council, you can figure out almost precisely what the losses would be to sectors and to the economy as a whole.
I know that you guys spoke a little bit at the meeting about the importance of spreading the word in the community. Can you speak a little bit to the power of local stakeholders and fishermen to making a change or doing something or whatever it may be to kind of make the situation better?
Wow, yeah. Well, in terms of resource losses, which is what's driving this. This is not a management decision that was based on allocation or any sort of management preferences or methods. This was a decision that was based purely on the resource itself. And so it's a problem that is less changeable than something that depends on fish politics or fisheries management policies. It's so elemental that, you know, the resource itself is telling us, you know, that we have to slow down the fishing because of the status of the resource. As you know, it was thought to have been caused by the warmer waters that were experienced around the Gulf in 2014, 15, and 16.
Yeah.
The blob. And we've seen those effects on other species, potentially even salmon, changing their migratory patterns and so forth. So I suppose you could take the big picture and say, you know, what's causing those climatic changes? Is there anything you can do to help ensure that that doesn't happen going forward? That's a question that's a little bit bigger than the community, but it certainly is a question that people have talked about. As far as the community goes, I think that, you know, this disaster declaration and the hopefully the mitigation coming from congressional allocation of money to the community will make a difference and a positive difference. And I think if community members want to participate in that process, they certainly can. Matt Greening from Stutz's office said, you know, he recommends that not only the communities, as in the city and borough, as they've already drafted, write a letter to the governor, and then from there to the delegation, but that individuals could also do that and have a voice that reaches Juneau at Washington, D.C. to help guarantee that that kind of mitigation might come through congressional action. So in terms of that, I certainly think that's a very positive step that people can take. I also think that the more we know, the better off we are. The surveys in the Gulf have been a little bit problematic over the last 2 years for a variety of reasons, mostly funding reasons through the National Marine Fisheries Service's lack of funding for surveys and the allocation of monies within the National Marine Fisheries Service. So that's another thing that both communities and individuals can approach, is approaching the delegation in particular on the National Marine Fisheries side, because it's a federal agency, asking the delegation to put all the work they can into helping NIMS get the money that they need to fulfill their responsibility in surveying the Gulf on a regular basis and surveying it completely, so that any changes and any increases or decreases, any kind of change and any kind of conditional information can be used by the scientists. I think that's huge going forward. So I think those two things, the public as well as the community entities, can participate in.
So looking back at the Pink Salmon Declaration, that still hasn't gotten any federal funds, so what makes it more likely that this disaster, if it goes through as a federal declaration, will get funds in time?
That's a good question. I think that pressure, I think there may be more, potentially more pain caused by this decline and more lasting pain. And I think the deeper the pain goes in a community, whether it be a sector or an actual town or a group of towns, I think the bigger the pain, the more the pressure, and the more likely it is that the powers that be get that message.
All right. I think those are all the questions I have. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No problem.